Meanwhile, an interview with Bart Sears about his career and drawing the Justice League Europe comic book. Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of the Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host. Now, if you've been a devoted listener of this podcast, well, welcome back. And if you're new around here, welcome to the embassy. For you new folks, each month on this podcast, we recap and discuss the Justice League comics that were released from 1987 to about 1992, when the main writers were Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis. We've been going issue by issue, month by month, in release order, covering all the various Justice League series and spin-offs from this era. We've been doing this for about 6.5 years now, and so far we've covered through Justice League America number 50, Justice League Europe number 26, and Justice League Quarterly number 3. Now, today, oh my gosh, we have a spectacular interview for you with the amazingly talented Bart Sears, the superstar artist responsible for launching the Justice League Europe series, plus so many other fantastic comics. And Bart was an absolute joy to speak with, as you're about to find out. Now, as a special bonus, this interview with Bart is also available on YouTube. Bart and I, we kept our cameras on for the discussion, so you can head over to the Fire and Water Podcast Network YouTube channel and watch the interview there as well. I'll include a link to that in the show notes for this podcast. Now, I'd like to give a huge thanks to some of the past guests of the show who helped me develop some of the questions for Bart. I crowdsourced question ideas from the following, so thank you to Dr. Ange, Carlin Trammell, Chris Lewis, Diablo Frank, Gus Casals, Jose Rivera, JT the Exterminator, Keechee Baker, Max Romero, Michael Bailey, Patrick Pence, Paul Keehan, Rob Kelly, Sean Ross, and Tim Price. I really appreciate your assistance in developing these questions for Bart. Now, as you're listening, we want you to be part of the discussion. Get out on the internet and share your thoughts, folks. Go out to our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI. Leave your thoughts on the show post. That's the best place where most of the conversation is happening. You can also find us on Twitter as JLI Podcast, or you can find us on Facebook as Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast. Now, before we get to the interview, I also would like to thank our Patreon supporters for their support. Because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows, it requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we need some help with the expenses. So we launched our Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JLI Podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW Podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire & Water Podcast Network. In a certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice. Just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JLI podcast. Our thanks to Chris Lewis, David A. Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, John Coos, John Ross Haynes, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Preeb, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. All right, there we go. With all of that out of the way, it is now time for our fantastic interview. So here we are with Bart Sears. Bart, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, man. This is a blast.
We're so excited.
Justice League was, you know, a comic phenomenon, I think, you know, in that era with international and Europe and everything. It was a great time for comics, I think.
It absolutely was. And you were an integral part in that explosion. And I'm really looking forward to digging into that. But I want to go back further first. Okay. I want to find out, what was it like for you to get interested in reading comics when you were a kid? Like, what were some of your favorites?
Ah, geez, man. When I was a kid, we had a corner store. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up, my brother's 4 years older, and he was always reading. And so there are always comics around. And my mother was very big on reading. I mean, she reads 5 books a week still. But so we learned to read very, very young. I mean, I don't remember ever not knowing how to read. And, you know, so there are comics always around. And we had this little corner store, you know, mm-hmm. little five mom and pop, five and dime kind of store. And just around, you know, I guess 8, 9, 10, they would get a box, little cardboard box every Friday of some other store's returns. You remember how they used to cut off? Cut off the title and just send the title back, and they'd get credit for the books. So they usually just throw out the books until somebody said, hey, we can sell these for, I think the first time I found that box, they were 20 comics for a dollar.
Oh, wow. Okay. Nice
so
deal.
I would just go through the box with my allowance and whatever my allowance was. I think it started at $1, and I would get, 20 books. I couldn't count on getting continued runs because it was just whatever returns were. So I was exposed to a lot of stuff, but I remember really liking Karate Kid.
Okay.
Back, Rick Estrada was drawing it, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the most memorable ones. And probably because I was able to collect that month after month because I was always in the box.
Yeah.
But that was my first really falling in love with comics. I mean, I read early. I probably read Conan and Tarzan at 7 or 8 and, continue to reread them. But I just fell in love with heroic fiction. And comics was such a visceral and easy way to digest heroic fiction that I just fell in love with it.
That's awesome. So what wanted you to make the jump from reading them to drawing them?
Well, my brother and I we sculpted little clay figures and dioramas and always played with stuff. And he was always drawing. So I picked up drawing. And, I had a talent for it. In elementary school, I was, doing comics and strips. And I didn't really think much about it. Mm-hmm. It was just what I did. And then I saw, I was around 10. And Neil Adams did this story. And I can't remember the number, but it was one of those 80-page super specials that DC used to do.
Sure.
It was a Batman or a detective one, and he did this story, Night of the Wolf, which was Batman fighting a werewolf. And I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And I saw that and I started to piece together, people do this for, a job. They do this. It doesn't just appear magically,
Right.
Started to figure out that, maybe I could do this for a job. I really like this. So I started tracing paper just to kind of figure out how people drew that way. Cause I had no idea. I was just, dumb kid. I have no idea. So I just started tracing that. And that was when I was around 10, I decided that I wanted to draw comics.
Oh, wow. Okay. So Neil Adams, obviously an early influence. Who else was an early influence for you?
Buscema, mm-hmm. Frazetta. Frazetta more for his paintings at that time than the ink art. I discovered his ink art probably a little later, in teen years.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he was, on all the Conan books and stuff. So I was familiar with that master's work. And Buscema, and a guy I really liked and actually have a lot of similarity to, which I didn't realize until later years, was Ross Andrew.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I noticed a lot of the way he and I do posing in lower legs, it's very similar. So I obviously glommed some of that.
We both have an amazing capture of anatomy as well.
And, that stuck with me. Who else? I loved George Tuska and Vinnie Coletta's Iron Man.
Yep.
Loved that stuff as a kid. That was awesome. God, who else? I'm so bad with names. Kuber and
sure.
Kirby. I first saw Kirby really in my early teenage years. I had they did those little paperbacks of comic art,
sure.
You could collection in a little box in the bookstore. And I had his Captain America one. And I thought it was just some of the most powerful, stunning stuff I'd seen. And that was before he got really stylized.
Mm-hmm.
So then I sought him out and saw the stylized stuff. And it didn't click in my head for years, what a brilliant transition that was and how smart it was as a commercial artist to stop trying to beat yourself up to draw more realistically and fully dive into style.
Right.
And still maintain that energy and the power, even those 4-panel grid pages, which is the most boring design ever of a page. But the panels just sang, just brilliant stuff.
So with you enjoying all these artists, how did it help you? Or I should say, how did you break in? How did you get through and finally get noticed?
Well, I went to the Kubert School right out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the Kubert School because I wanted to get into film.
Oh, okay.
And I wanted to go to USC for film. When I looked in high school at the entrance stuff, you had to write like an 8-page essay or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was I can't use a typewriter because I gave up writing because I couldn't type. And it was so frustrating. I just stopped writing, which was my first actual real love because I love, Conan and Tarzan. I wanted to write. Mm-hmm. And I gave that up because drawing was easier. So I just draw stories. And I was like, oh, I don't, I, I don't even know what I'd write about. So I'm like, and USC was expensive. So I was like, hey, you know what? I know I can draw comics. I know I have the ability. I'll go to the Hubert School for however long and refine my skills. And then I'll put myself through USC by drawing comics.
Okay.
Moronic idea. But you know, it sounded like a good plan. And in my second year at Hubert School, I burnt out. I couldn't draw anything. And I quit. And that was tough. I mean, Joe pulled me in his office and was like, you know, I don't think you want to do this. You know, I know, I understand you're burnt out. What about if I got you real work? We can go up to DC tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I couldn't. I mean, as much as I, you know, I was like, oh, my God, this is kind of amazing. But I couldn't say yes because I knew I would fail because I couldn't draw anything. So if I took them up on it and went up there and they gave me something to do and I failed, you know, how miserable would that make me feel on top of feeling so miserable as, you know, I felt at that point anyways. So I just said no and I quit. I went and moved furniture for a while. My dad was a warehouse manager for a furniture moving company at the time. Hmm. So that was my job all the time. So I went there and did that and met my first wife. And I decided, you know what? Maybe drawing isn't so bad. So I did some sample pages and just drove down to Marble. I live, you know, in upstate New York. So I drove to Manhattan and knocked on Marble's door and a very young Mike Carlin.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And looked at my stuff and liked it enough. He let me in and took me around and I met a bunch of editors and started getting work.
Okay. Wow.
Different times.
Right.
Back then. This was, you know, 1985.
Right.
You know, nobody wanted to draw comics back then. It wasn't cool. Even though they sold great. There just weren't 100,000 of them every month out there in the shelves either. So,
right, I was going to say that no one's getting in on that plan nowadays. So,
no.
let's talk about Hubert School for a second. So, I didn't realize I knew you had gone there. I didn't know you dropped out. And so, how did that cycle back into you being a teacher there? Because what a lot of people may not realize is that you've been giving back for a long time. From early on in your career, you were teaching at Hubert School and you were doing Brutes and Babes and Wizard Magazine. So, you have been helping the next generation for a long time. How'd you make that transition to teaching there?
Well, I stayed friends with the buddies, you know, lifelong buddies I made at the Hubert School, you know, Mark Pennington, Mark Bam, Graham Nolan, a bunch of guys whose names I'm forgetting right now, but will come back to me. And, you know, they went through there, though. Well, Graham did. Graham dropped out after the second year. He didn't go back for the third. But Pennington started teaching there after, when was this? He went back to teaching there after Hasbro, and they were looking for a teacher, and he's like, you want me to mention you? And I said, sure. And they were like, yeah, that'd be great. I was doing Justice League at the time and just about ending my run on that. I think I started Dark Knight the same year I was teaching the first Dark Knight story I did. And it was fun for me because I'd drive down on a Thursday night and stay with Pennington, and we'd hang out and party and do stuff until early hours in the morning, then get up and drive to the Hubert School and teach, then go back and Friday night, you know, same thing all over again. And I'd either leave Friday if I really had a lot to do or just take off Saturday morning and go back to Syracuse. So
it was a
fun, crazy time.
So what attracted you to the teaching, or what did you enjoy about the process of teaching?
Thinking. So much of what we do, I mean, it's a commercial art. The more you do, the faster you do it, the more you make. I mean, literally, I mean, that's how I was trained at the Hubert School.
Right.
You know, it was like you have a deadline, you get the job done, you know, and they push up your deadline, you do whatever you have to, you get the job done. And that's how you make money. Because this was, I mean, they were all training Joe and all those guys before royalties were even an idea in anyone's head. And royalties had started, I guess, early 80s, they first started paying royalties. You know, Neil and a bunch of those guys pushed for, and I think Paul Levitz and a bunch of those guys, you know, championed that cause. But that wasn't, you know, nobody knew royalties existed until you got in the industry. I mean, nobody mentioned it at Hubert School. I didn't know it was even a thing. I had no idea until you started working in the industry. So I had that old school mentality of more, faster, better, stronger, you know, that kind of thing. And geez, what was your question?
That's okay. It was about what attracted you to teaching. But, you know, it's interesting. You're talking about the more you draw, the better, you know, the more you're going to make.
Oh, yeah.
And yet you still took the time while you were drawing to go teach. That's amazing. You were doing both.
Well, I loved it because it made me think. Not so much creating lessons. And I think for the Hubert School, the year I was there, I think all the lesson plans were these one sheet things. And then you could adjust them to, you know, your sensibilities a little bit. But what I loved was the back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
To me, there's always, even when I was a kid, there were how-to books on how to draw. And of course, with the internet and everything else, you know, how-to is everywhere. I mean, you can find how to do anything in the world 8 million times on the internet. But what always fascinated me was the why. Why did you make that decision? Why did you choose this line over that line? Why did you choose, you know, what was your thought process that led to the creation of this page? That's always been what fascinated me. And I find that in teaching, in the back and forth of questions and answers, I really had to dissect what I was just doing kind of by rote, just because, okay, I have this page done, what do I want to do here? You know, you don't really think about it as you're doing it. It's not like, I need four choices for this. No, you just, you know, you just do it because you got to get that page done that day, you know, and even an easy page takes you, you know, 6 hours sitting at the desk. You know, a hard page can take 12, 14, 16 hours of desk work, depending on the level of complexity. So you've got to rip through these decisions. And, you know, I found you just stopped thinking about it. You know, you're just doing it. You're doing it. You're doing it. And I was always lucky that I had enough talent that even bad decisions I can make up for by making it pretty, you know. But in teaching, I had to figure out, you know, why that worked or why that didn't work and how to explain why I did this or what I was thinking when I did this. And I find that fascinating.
And also, interestingly, you were, as I said, a young guy there. I mean, you were just starting your career, and yet a lot of the other teachers were older. My podcasting partner actually went to the Cuber School, and that's one of the things he noted when we were talking, getting ready for this interview, is that a lot of his teachers were towards the end of their career, and you were at the beginning. How different was that for you then, doing that?
I mean, it was weird. I've never been comfortable, you know, being like the center of attention, you know, with 20 eager faces looking to me to enlighten and entertain them. You know, that's not a comfortable position for me. You know, I draw comics. I like to sit alone in a room for 12 days. I haven't done this for almost 40 years. You know, so I'm much more comfortable in my own head doing my own thing. That was weird. Luckily, Justice League was pretty popular. So, you know, all the kids there were very familiar with me.
Okay.
You know, whether they cared or not, that's a different matter. But so I wasn't coming in there like, oh, who's this guy? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I had some cachet before I went in. So at least they sat and listened.
Okay.
You know, which made it a little easier. And, you know, there were a bunch of good kids in those classes. So I found it pretty easy. I mean, it paid dirt. So I only did it for a year because I just couldn't function. I mean, it was losing money proposition, even as much as I enjoyed it mentally.
Yeah.
Just financially and you know, lifestyle wise, it wasn't feasible to continue. So I didn't.
Gotcha. So let's talk about your art style a little bit here. So, I mean, you mentioned yourself, you've been drawing a few years now, and your art is very unique. I mean, when you see a Bart Sears drawing, you know it's Bart Sears. There's never a doubt about that. So how was your work received initially? Like, what challenges did you have to overcome early on in your career?
I kind of hate to say it, but none.
Okay.
I mean, I was doing, I got into comics initially through Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Larry Hama was the first guy that hired me, and he gave me a black and white biker chick story. And I did not want to draw motorcycles. I did not want to draw chicks. You know, I want to draw Spider-Man. And the Spider-Man editor would have given me work if he had any, but he's like, come back in a couple months, you know, because I really like your stuff. And I was like, oh, but I did the biker chick story and I hated it. And I penciled it and I took it into Larry and he was like, okay, that's cool. Go ink it. And he threw it back at me. And I was like, I can't ink. So I went and inked it. And it's awful stuff. I hated it. Luckily, I don't think it was ever printed. And in the meantime, they gave me a toy comic, Skulk and Trancula from, God, what was it? I can't think of the name of the toy line. Insectoids or something like that.
Oh, Sectars. I saw that in your bio. Yeah.
Yeah. And I got the Skulk and Trancula book, which I much enjoyed drawing that. And that was easy for me. And but I inked that first 8-pager, Iron Rose was the name of the story. And I took it into Larry and he's like, okay, here's the second one. So I took that 8-page second one and I hated the first one so much. It took me more than two months to do the pencils for the second one.
Mm-hmm.
As I had this image in my head of what it had to look like. And the first one, you know, I was just going through it and getting it done. And the second one, I'm like, oh, that was so shitty. I've got to do better on this. This has to be, you know, what I do. This is my life, my career. But it took forever and it was killing me. And it came out pretty good. I don't think I have copies of it. Any of that early stuff, but maybe somewhere. I took it in or mailed it in. I don't know, but I didn't do any more work for Marvel. I just realized that I wasn't ready to do comics yet. It's too much work. It's too hard. I don't have enough tools in my tool chest to pull this off.
Okay.
I mean, if it was Spider-Man in Streets of New York City, I could have faked it for years and gotten there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, motorcycles and biker chicks and, you know, normal people in strange situations, you know, I wasn't good enough to do that then, at least to the level I wanted to do it. So I started doing more illustration for like TSR and,
yep,
and stuff. Yeah. So I got pretty much dove right out of comics into illustration. And at that time, which was before I taught, of course, at the Kubert School, my buddy Mark Pennington had gotten hired by Hasbro to do G.I. Joe.
Mm.
If people aren't aware, back in the day, the G.I. Joe concept guys would create, I don't know, 30 G.I. Joes, a different, you know, trench fighter, whatever they were, just different kinds of G.I. Joes. And they would design them and they would send them out to painters to do presentation paintings of each character. And then these presentation paintings, they would put in the big auditorium, and the powers that be at Hasbro, they'd have a meeting every month or whatever. And they would look at, okay, we've got these 30 figures, and they would pick the 22 that were going to be Joes that year.
Okay.
Based off these paintings and what they were and how they fit in the line. And so I started to do those paintings for Joe. After, I don't know, a little while of that, they asked, you know, they brought me in for an interview and hired me to be another G.I. Joe artist, concept guy. And I started to learn the ropes and worked on Joe for 2 weeks when they got the Cops and Crooks line. And they just said, this is yours. Go do it. And they wanted me to do it on the little G.I. Joe bucks, but they wanted to do them 5.5 inches tall instead of 3.5 inches tall.
Okay.
And I was like, these bucks are boring. I mean, they're lame. They're, you know, skinny shouldered. I mean, these things are boring as heck. How about I do 3 new bucks, the bucks of different body types that are, you know, heroic. And they were like, oh, that's a great idea. So I got to design the actual bucks that the engineers then engineered to make the toys. And I don't know if people are aware, but they would print out these bucks in plastic. And the bucks are the joints, basically.
Okay.
Spaces between the joints. So there'd be a ball joint here, you know, and a piece of thing. And then where the elbow joint was. And so all these separate things. But that's what these sculptors would sculpt over so that, you know, the joints would work. They had certain parameters they couldn't go over. And I was always pushing that with the designs. But yeah, it was a blast getting to do Cops and Crooks. And so I did like, I designed 2 G.I. Joes and did some, you know, sculpture sheets for a couple others. And that was my time on Joe, that and the presentation paintings.
That's awesome. Rest
of Cops and WWF and
oh, yeah, stuff. So do you feel like working in that case, you had to work 3-dimensionally, right? So you've, yes, been a 2D artist and you had to work 3-dimensionally. Do you feel like that affected your art or maybe vice versa?
Well, I'd always sculpted.
Oh, that's right. You and your brother.
In high school, I did a bunch of, well, I was really lucky in high school. My high school art teacher was a sculptor by nature, but he was, I'm so bad with words. he wasn't a realist. What? No, not surrealist, but he was.
Hi, Michelle.
She's on the way up to the other room. But he saw that I was illustrative minded, and he gave me the Andrew Loomis, the first Andrew Loomis book I ever saw, which was, I think, just, you know, How to Draw or whatever. Maybe it was How to Draw the Human Figure. I can't remember which one it was. But he's like, you know, this is my book, but you can use it. You can borrow, you can take it home, you can do whatever. And, you know, that opened my eyes to structure.
Mm.
And in 11th grade, when I wanted to get into film, he actually let me do an animated film for like half the year in school. He always gave me separate assignments that I didn't have to do what the rest of the class did, because he was trying to guide me illustratively. And he told me, he's like, I don't know anything about illustration. I will guide you as best I can and give you stuff because I know that's where you're headed.
Okay.
Which was super cool. I mean, but anyhow, he let me do this animated film I wanted to do. And I created all these metal armatures like Harryhausen did. And I sculpted these figures and cast them in foam rubber and did all this stuff.
Wow.
So I'd been sculpting for years and years. So I was always thinking in 3D. Even when I first started, when I was 8 or 9 or 10, you know, wanting to draw comics, I had been sculpting figures and stuff for years. So I already saw 3-dimensionally. So if anything, that has been the basis of my art, is thinking 3-dimensionally. You know, I always think about structure.
And I think you can see it in your work too. Cause I mean, a lot of times people tend to draw characters from the front, you know, that's where you see, but you're always doing different kind of angles. I mean, we joke a lot on the show about how you and if, we're going to ask about Keith Giffen and layout breakdowns, but you guys love a butt shot, you know, and that's something a lot of people don't do. They don't know how to do. They don't know the right angles. They don't know a way to make the physique look right.
Right.
So let's use that as a segue. Let's jump into Justice League. Let's talk about this. So how did you get the assignment for starters? And what was that like for you knowing you were drawing a Justice League book?
Well, it came from Hasbro. I had done the Cops toy line and I had done all the presentation art and all the package art with Mark and Mark, my two buddies from the Kubert School. We kind of massaged our way in there because that was freelance work that we weren't allowed to do. So we had our friend Mark McNabb in Jersey, who is colorist. He was the artist doing it all. And I'm pretty sure the guy in marketing knew that it was us because there were no flies on him. But he didn't care because it looked great. But DC, Doug Munch, and Andy Helfer came up to Hasbro to do the Cops comic. Mm-hmm. And the marketing guy was like, I want you to come into this meeting and bring your portfolio. I know you've drawn some comics. You want to do more and blah, blah, blah. You know, maybe you can get some work or something. I was like, sweet. So I went and sat in a meeting, and then they looked at my portfolio, and Helfer was like, hey, you want to draw some comics? I'm like, sure. And he's like, okay. So he called me, and he's like, okay, I want you to do this as your Cops, but do not quit your job. Do not quit your job. Do not quit. I can't promise you anything. Do not quit your job. So the first thing I did was quit Hasbro.
And, so you listened and you follow instructions well.
Well, I knew I could draw comics. I understood what he was saying is I don't want to be responsible for you and your family and all this stuff. I can't guarantee anything, but I knew I would be able to get work and I knew I was ready to do comics. So he gave me Cops number 4 to pencil, mm-hmm. which I did. And then this is when I should have known how comics worked. Because then he gave me issue 3 to do. So I did issue 4 because the artist on this new book was already late. And then I had to do issue 3 because he was still late, even though I'd already completed issue 4. And
oh,
I did
wow.
For Cops. And my reward for that was to be the monthly artist on Spectre.
Oh, okay.
So Spectre 18 or 21, I can't remember which number. But I started it, and there were 24-page stories back then. And I really didn't want to do Spectre. I mean, I wanted to do Spider-Man, Batman. I wanted, you know, superhero. I mean,
sure.
Spectral hero, okay, and I'll draw muscular and stuff. But, you know, I wanted the more meat and potatoes. And I got about six pages in. It was a Monday afternoon. I just finished or was just finishing page 6. And I got a call from Andy saying, hey, this dude just quit and screwed us. I need you to do issue 3 of Invasion. And I didn't know at the time, but it was McFarlane, and he quit Invasion to do Spider-Man.
Oh, right.
Probably a smart move.
Just a bit.
And I was like, okay, I can do that. He's like, it's 80 pages. You're only going to have 10 weeks to do it. You're going to have to do 8 pages a week. I'm like, oh, all right, I can do it. Whatever. And I was really happy to get off Spectre, to be honest. And, you know, it was a big crossover event. You know, I knew it was a big deal.
Sure.
He's like, okay, you got to come in Friday, like at 11 for a big meeting about the book. I'm like, okay, I'll drive down. I lived in Syracuse. It's like 5-6 hour drive, whatever. So I'll leave, you know, 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. or something. And I'll get there. He's like, you know, and you got to bring in Spectre pages. I'm like, okay, I'll bring in what I got done. He's like, I need all the Spectre pages.
Ooh.
I'm like, there's 18 pages left, Andy. He's like, yeah. It's like 5 o'clock Monday. I got to leave at 5 a.m. Friday. That's 3 days to do 18 pages. He's like, yeah, you can do it. And so many of my phone calls with him were, you can do it, Bart. You can do it. No, I can't do it. I can't do that. Yes, you can. You can do it, Bart. I know you can do it. And finally, I'd be like, oh, all right, I'll do it. So I agreed, and I banged out 18 pages and drove them in on Friday morning.
Oof.
Got, you know, picked up whatever I needed to and listened to whatever I had to listen to for Invasion. And that was, you know, when I first worked with Keith because mm-hmm. he wrote. And the only way I was able to do it is because, as you know, Keith wrote in layouts
yep.
with his suggested dialogue. So all I did was blow up those pages to 10x15 image size. And I would throw them in a light box and then I would do my layout right over them. And that was the only way it was possible, simply because all the storytelling was there. So I could make them cool.
Sure.
But I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have to start from a blank page because I would have never been able to do 8 pages a week of any quality without that. So that was a huge saving grace. You know, I ended up doing all the covers and the poster, which is weird. Remember the Invasion poster?
Is that the one where he's reaching down? Yeah.
People are running. Mack Groening designed that.
No way.
He gave me the sketch. It's like, yeah, Mack Groening did the sketch for us. And I'm like, why is the Simpson creator doing a sketch for a DC crossover poster? I still don't know why or how that happened, but that was the layout that I had to work from.
I remember the first time I saw that image was an ad in a comic, and I was convinced it was a joke. I'm like, what are they doing, a 1950s alien? What's going on here? Because I wasn't reading the trades back then. I wouldn't follow what was going on. It was just like out of the blue. And, you know, it's so iconic now. Yeah, absolutely. I know what you're talking about.
So that was fun. But my reward for helping them out and getting the book done and doing 8 pages a week for 10 weeks was the spinoff book, which was Justice League Europe.
Awesome. That's incredible. So you mentioned Giffen and his breakdowns, right? So how much of a role did that play in your work? I mean, did he do them always? Did you keep them?
Oh, yeah, that's how he wrote. And, you know, I mean, it's just super helpful because, and I'm sure that's influenced a lot of my storytelling and a lot of, you know, how I view things. And it certainly helped me in my early career because I didn't have to think blank pages. You know, I had even a little rough sketch of them, even 6-panel page, you know, it shows you, okay, this is what's got to be seen to tell the story, you know, just super simple, basic, but, you know, in case, pretty powerful storytelling. And, you know, that was certainly, I would say a crutch early on, but it was definitely a huge benefit.
Okay. Now, did you have a lot of room to interpret, or was it you're doing
this?
Oh,
yeah, I could do whatever I wanted.
Okay.
That was just, and I don't know if they let me or not, but I did. But that's what I learned in Kubert School. One thing I took from Joe, one of the big things was the writer's written a script. He hands it to you. It is now your story. Mm-hmm. You can't change the story, but it is now your story to tell. You have to make this yours. So, you know, that was it. Once I got a script in my hand, it's like, it's mine. I don't care if you want a splash page here. That's not the best thing for the story. It's going to be here, you know, whatever the case, or panels or adjusting stuff. You know, change the story, but I might, you know, and often, you know, I always do what I think is best for the story.
Well, in Justice League, you mentioned inkers earlier. So and this is a question a lot of folks have asked. I should point out, by the way, before this interview, I sort of crowdsourced questions from a lot of the past guests of the show. So a lot of these come from listeners of the show. And a lot of people asked about your artistic process. Like when you start laying out a page and drawing it, do you think about the inker? Or is it like, you know what, you're just going to trust the inker to do their job and you just put it all out there?
Early on, I did not. Early on, it was, you know, I was too busy doing my shit to worry about who comes next.
Okay.
And that's how it started with Justice League. I mean, I never wanted to do a teen book. I certainly didn't want to do a book in Europe where I had to draw, you know, Paris and all those buildings that I wasn't familiar with. I mean, I could draw New York in my sleep, but, you know, these centuries old buildings and the cobblestone streets and all that stuff, I certainly wasn't familiar with that. So, you know, I had a lot of reference books and stuff, but it wasn't, you know, something I was like, oh, I can't wait to draw that. I was like, oh, God. You know, the Justice League embassy, you know, in Europe, in Paris was this, you know, monstrous, you know, I don't even know what the architectural style was, but there was a lot of crap to it. I couldn't fake it real easy.
It was a lot of detail,
It was tough. And of course, I was young and eager then, so that made it a little easier.
Well, did you have any favorite inkers? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Pablo Marcus was the first inker on the book. Mm-hmm. And I remember Andy wasn't thrilled because Pablo would let his kids ink backgrounds.
Oh.
And, you know, I remember being in the office once, and I guess Pablo brought him pages, or he was talking to him on the phone. I can't remember if it was in person or over the phone. I guess it was in person because I can remember, you know, I heard Pablo's responses. But Andy would be like, you let your daughter ink this face in the background, didn't you? He's like, but Andy, she really wanted to. He's like, you have to stop doing that, Pablo. I'm going to have to stop giving you work if you keep letting your kids ink parts of your pages and stuff. blah, blah, blah. And, you know, Pablo did a good job. I was never 100% thrilled with it, but I didn't know what I was doing either. And then I don't know why he left, or I don't know, but I had a friend I met in Syracuse, Randy Elliott, who was kind of breaking the comics. And I managed to hook him up for inking Justice League.
Yep.
And he was real old school. He was an assistant to Woody way back in the day and different stuff. So, and his stuff was really old school. It had a real 50s kind of flair. I didn't want that, you know, on my stuff. And so I kept things really open initially, and I slowly started adding in really fine rendering. Mm-hmm. You picked up on and started doing crazy stuff with. So I glommed more that way. So that was brilliant. I think, you know, by 14, 15, the Extremist Saga and the Starro one, we were really firing on all cylinders. Everything, it was just gorgeous stuff.
We're covering the Starro stuff right now on the show, and we just did the first issue, and we're just gushing about all the fine details and all the gorgeous, you know, the giant splashes of Starro. All right, you know what? Random question thrown at you, because we debate a lot of stuff on the show. Like, yeah. I don't know whether you put this stuff in there or it's in Keith's layouts, but every once in a while, there's just this really cool thing in the background. It's not the focus of the story. Like, I know this is 30 years ago, and I'm asking a super nerdy question, but like, there's a whole scene where they're just flying somewhere, and Rocket Red has this giant platform, and he's pulling it, and he's got these giant chains, and he's pulling it. And I'm like, that couldn't have possibly been in the pencil in the breakdowns. We're just speculating whether
it's suggested. I mean, Keith would just, you know, he'd do like not stick figures, but simple figures and simple stuff, and I would just run with it.
So, okay. Yeah. Artistically beautiful, creative stuff is what it was.
Yeah, I think it was a blast. I mean, I wish I understood how much fun it was. In hindsight, it was so much fun. At the time, you know, you're just grinding. You got the kids and family trying to pay bills. And, you know, you don't think about it. But, you know, that's a job. We've all wanted DC to revisit it, but they just won't.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is a shame. But, yeah, if there was something in there, I would say 90% it was implied somewhere in what Keith had laid out.
Okay. Well, I also want to say that the digital comic era is really been a blessing for your work. Because, you know, I got my physical issues, right? And I go through those. But then looking at the digital ones, I mean, you have such a beautiful fine line that the old paper comics, I mean, they kind of, the ink eats it up. So seeing these things digitally, oh my gosh. I mean, they just.
I stopped rendering.
Yeah.
Because the printing was so bad. And if you had a big run and they're using plastic plates, you'd start seeing all your little lines. They would start wiggling as the plastic plates heated up, they would start to just break down and wiggle, which was crazy. And I really prefer the color from the 80s, late 80s, especially the early computer color where they had some gradients, but it wasn't, you know, so overblown.
Right.
So well, and so overpainted. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much why I stopped rendering, was because the printing was pretty much so awful. I'm like, I'll just do shapes and heavy blacks and then, you know, I'll do texture for certain things, but I'm not going to do all this crazy rendering because it just gets crap. And then once computer color came out, I was like, yeah, I'm never rendering again.
It's just going to be colored. Well, the digital versions look amazing. They look absolutely astonishing. It's great to see your work in that format.
Thank you.
So everyone knows, if you want something to look shiny, 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 Bart's your guy. That's who you go to. Captain Atom, Rocket Red. You know, was that a talent that you just knew you had, or did you have to develop it for like a book like this?
If you look through the Justice League issues, it certainly changed over time how I treated, especially Captain Atom and his chrome. Mm-hmm. And it was a big learning curve for me, you know, because when I started, you know, what did I know about drawing chrome? I mean, I don't know. And so I developed a style and that I grew into and how I did Captain Atom Chrome. And, you know, it's different than how I do Silver Surfer Chrome and different from how I do different other chromes. But yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely something I dove into I had to make it look real to me, at least in my world. So it was definitely something I worked at and grew and I think figured out how to do over time.
Okay.
Initially, there was a lot of useless stuff in it. It muddied the works, I thought. And so I started to find ways to like get a better effect simpler.
Okay. No, it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So, you know, again, looking at Captain, I'm looking at the physiques and all that, right? You've got a lot of muscle bound, huge, gorgeous men, gorgeous women. You know, you're very fair to the fans. You played an equal amount of beefcake and cheesecake throughout this stuff. You really did. So, yeah. You know, first of all, like, what kind of reference did you use? I mean, were you using like, I don't know, bodybuilder magazines or something, or just knew it?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
I don't like referencing humans. I mean, occasionally I will reference like a specific angle or something that is unclear just to try to get in my head how it works in my style. But I'm not a big reference guy. I mean, okay. I reference for cars and buildings and background stuff that I don't know or understand or haven't drawn before. But humans, I don't. I don't like to reference faces. You know, I don't base characters on, you know, somebody I know or actors or actresses. I just decide what they look like in my head, and then I draw them.
There's been a massive debate amongst the listeners about Power Girl's face, just so you know. Like, there's a bunch of people that are convinced she's based off of, I'm blanking, the girl on Night Court.
Marky Post.
Yes. So a lot of people are convinced she's Marky Post. Denise Crosby as well. I mean, there's a large, so all in your head, huh?
Yep.
Okay. All right.
Always here. I looked at Wally's stuff when I started, and that's where it grew from.
Okay. Well, you know, all right, speaking of Wally, speaking about gorgeous physique, so you drew everyone very sexy. I don't think there's ever been as sexy a Justice League as it went under your pencils. So did you ever get any pushback on that? Did you ever purposely crank it up, crank it down, any of that?
I did find out. I was trying to keep Wally's idea alive of every time you see Power Girl, her breasts are larger. And I didn't know until... because back in the day there, I didn't see the inks. I didn't see the colors. You know, I saw the book when it came out, which is, you know, 6-8 months maybe after I penciled it or something.
Sure.
But when I would send in pages, Andy, I took in pages one day, and this was like, I think in a Starro issue, there's a splash page of Power Girl walking Captain Adam next to him, and they're on a rooftop and the gang's around or something. And he's like, "You mother." And he gets out his razor and erases her breasts and he draws them smaller. I'm like, okay, that can be ink now. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I know what you're doing. I know what you're doing. He's like, I do this all the time on this stuff. I'm like, oh. So that was the only thing. No, I never got any pushback other than, you know, well, if we love this stuff, keep it going.
So would you do anything differently nowadays, given the just the way people look at sexuality nowadays? Would you have changed any of that?
No, I treated them all, I think, fairly equally.
So, and you really did. There's, because we've got a lot of female listeners as well. Female guests have been on the show. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of beefcake, a lot of cheesecakes. You're a very equal opportunity, sexy guy.
No, I think I never saw, and I don't like superhero comics that look like people.
You know, okay.
Realistic phase. That doesn't have any attraction to me. You know, when I did Legends of the Dark Knight the first time, I purposely drew Batman how people would remember him rather than maybe how he really was. Because obviously nobody can be that big in real. So, you know, to different extents, that's how I view superheroes, is you cannot see anyone like this. You know, I mean, some basketball players would come close because the proportions are so, you know, huge and their heads are relatively tiny and extremely muscular these days. But for the most part, I've tried to, you know, draw fantasy.
Okay. Yeah. So as far as other stuff you get to do in the book, you got to design some new costumes too. So Crimson Fox, you know, from scratch, and then Power Girl's new costume. So what goes into designing a look like that? Or maybe what were some things about those looks that you liked or you were intentionally putting behind there?
Well, one thing I learned at Hasbro is the design you want to use, make that the coolest looking figure.
Okay.
At Hasbro, when I got there, you would do like 6 different roughs for a character.
Mm-hmm.
You put them up on a board, and the marketing guy and Greg, the head of Boys Toys, would come in, and they'd say, "I love these boots. I like this one, but I want these boots. I want this thing," and blah blah blah. And I realized they were always picking the coolest figure because they'd each have a different pose. So they'd always pick the coolest figure, but then they populate it with all the other stuff from all the other things. So you'd have this conglomeration of design. So I got this idea. I'm just going to draw one figure and do 6 different designs on the light box on this one figure. And I just remember when they first walked in, they saw these 6 designs on the wall where the figure is exactly the same. They didn't know what to do. You know, I swear it was like 5 minutes of silence as they were looking at it because nothing looked cool. You know, nothing stood out. They couldn't pick this one. And then so it made it a lot tougher for them. And I think maybe, I don't know if the designs changed any, but it was a lot easier for me because I only had to draw one figure and then just a bunch of different details. So, you know, I've carried that through on design stuff. So with Power Girl's design, they want to see some rough. So I did some really crappy ones and boring poses. And then I did the costume, which they ended up using, which I really didn't want to change her costume. I thought,
This
is ridiculous. You know, she's kind of iconic character. I mean, changing for the sake of changing just seems dumb to me. But, you know, I did the sleek one on the cool pose, and that's the one they picked. So,
okay. Well, if Power Girl ever has to have an alternate costume, the one you developed is the one to go with. I mean, it looks fantastic. It looks great.
I mean, I like the design. I just would have never changed Power Girl.
Understood. There's a lot to be said for iconic. So Crimson Fox, like that, speaking of iconic, that hood. I mean, that hood that flows like a cape. I mean, that was interesting. No one's been able to draw it like you either, unfortunately, since then.
Still don't even understand it myself. Everyone's mugging Crimson Fox. Commissioner the show, and I'm like, why did I do this hood? I don't even understand how it works, which is rare for me because usually I'm anal about... You know, in 3D, this has to work in 3D, and I really don't understand it. I just try to draw it so it looks cool.
Well, it does look cool.
It does look like it better than her costume in the TV show.
Yeah.
I will say. I was extremely disappointed when I saw that.
Yeah. That, it was a fun show, but they missed a lot of the character stuff. You know, like the regular humans in the office, that was funny, but the character stuff, they missed a lot of opportunities, unfortunately.
Didn't last. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, it's because comedy's hard, and that's actually leads me to our next question. So, you know, like, for example, Justice League number six, Europe number six, that's the night school one, right? I mean, that thing is legendary among the fans. I put that one in my wife's hands, who doesn't care anything about comics, and even she thought that was hilarious. So, what are some of the challenges drawing humor? I mean, humor's hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. When I got into comics, I was drawing, you know, steely-eyed heroes. And I remember Andy got the first issue. He's like, you got to open their eyes. You got to see the pupil. And so I really had to learn expression, you know, for Justice League, because I had always drawn, you know, steely-eyed heroes and sniveling villains and, you know, scared people. But now you have to do this wealth of emotions, which is really, you know, difficult if you aren't a natural, you know, portrait artist or something, I guess. I don't know. And Justice League was over the top, so you could really, and it's comics, so you can always go a little farther, you know, especially in my view of comics, which is it's a fantasy. It's not real life. It just has to look like it could be real. So that's how I did the emotion when, you know, Keith would write something or, you know, draw it, the dialogue. I would try to get to the heart of it and expand it as much as I could to make it as over the top, but believable as possible. If that makes sense.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. And I wasn't a fan of humor in comics, you know?
Okay.
And probably because there weren't a lot of comics that were funny.
Around that time, yeah, humor books really were kind of,
Justice League was the first, you know, funny book I'd ever read that was actually funny, you know, the first Justice League they did. So I was a little prepped for that. And I knew Justice League Europe would have a more serious tone. I mean, that was one of the things they wanted to do with that book, which was right up my alley, you know. Blood, guts, and death with a couple of jokes is you know, how I see life. So that was perfect.
Blood, guts, and death with a little bit of jokes. I think that's going to be your new tagline.
I'm fine with that.
So did you have any favorite storylines from your time on Justice League Europe?
Well, six was just a knee slapper from the get-go. I got that. I was like, you are kidding me. You know, it was so ridiculous, but I knew it'd be pretty funny. Or at least I hope people would think it was funny because it was just so ridiculous. I mean, I don't know. But that one, the Starro one and the Extremis were my favorites.
I didn't like
the ending of the Extremis when it became, when they were all animatronics that I didn't like so much. But up until that point, that and the Starro one were my favorites.
And artistically, I mean, regardless of how that story ended, artistically, it was exceptional. I mean, just explosive, bombastic. It was so much fun. And to get to draw Marvel analogs, those were fun.
Yeah, it was fun designing them too, you know, secretly, because they weren't based off Marvel characters.
I'll admit it. So, you know, 1990, I'm all of, 18 years old, whatever. I didn't even see it. It wasn't until I started doing this show that people started writing in about Extremis being Marvel, you know, analogs. And I'm like, what are you guys talking about? And I looked, I'm like, oh, my God. I had no idea.
Yeah.
So mission accomplished. You fooled some people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the instructions were do, you know, Magneto, do Dr. Ock, do, you know, so... That's what I did.
So who is your favorite leaguer to draw?
Probably Captain Atom.
Okay.
Followed by Metamorpho. And I had to draw Metamorpho. I couldn't draw that lumpy character that he was before. I just couldn't do it. So I had to find a style for him. And they didn't seem to care. So I was happy. Power was fun. Flash, you know, just her. It was so much fun doing their interaction. You know, they were always a blast.
I think you set the tone for Metamorpho going forward. I mean, he's had that kind of echoing of your style since then.
Good. It just made him a hero. He just, I don't know. He just seemed like a non-entity before. I just couldn't draw that.
So let's step away from Justice League for a little bit. Let's talk about some other stuff. So the Wizard magazine, Brutes and Babes. How'd you land that gig? And I mean, I know I've read some stuff from you about the legacy of that, and even today, is that right?
Yeah. I was pretty lucky. I mean, I was teaching at the Kubert School, and my buddy Mark McNabb was running the Kubert School graphic studio. They had a graphic studio for a while. And I don't know how he met Garib Sheamus, who started Wizard, but I know they had a comic shop not far from where we were in Jersey, across the border in New York. So I don't know if Mark went there and met him that way, or if Garib came to Kubert School looking for some advice on, you know, how to put a book together, a magazine together, or whatever. But he and Mark hooked up somehow. And Mark was like, hey, you got to get my buddy Bart to do some covers. And he's like, Bart who? And he's like, Bart, seriously, oh, the Justice League guy? He's like, yeah, yeah. So I started doing some covers and a bunch of little wizards and stuff. So initially, they wanted, you know, wizard hat or wizard stars on every cover. And they wanted all these little wizards and stuff in the corner. So I did some of that stuff. And one day he called and said, hey, I know you're teaching at the Kubert School. How do you feel about doing a drawing column? Like, well, sounds fun to me. And he's like, all right, come up with something and we'll do it. So I came up with Brutes and Babes. And that was that. It was always one of their favorite, one of their most beloved features in that book for a long time.
And it's clearly influenced a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people still credit that with teaching them how to draw.
I've been really, really lucky and humbled by that, because, you know, you sit alone in a room, you do this stuff, it goes out, it gets printed, you get a copy, you're like, okay, cool. But you don't think anything about it. And it really wasn't until late 90s or 2000s, when I was doing a lot of shows with CrossGen, that people started to come up and say, I loved your Brutes and Babes. It taught me to draw. It really inspired me, you know, pros and non-pros. I mean, a lot of guys, like, I really thought I could draw, you know, and I really tried your lessons and everything else. And I learned so much, but I realized I didn't have it, you know, or whatever. But I just love your lessons. I learned so much about, you know, what goes into comics and different stuff, or, you know, I do tattoos now, or, you know, whatever. I've got a lot of that. And a lot of pros that have said, you know, it really inspired them early on and gave them something they look forward to. And they, you know, poured over the lessons and different stuff. It's really, I don't know, it's pretty crazy, really. I mean, to think how you can affect people, you know, just with the crap you do alone in your room, I guess.
Well, you certainly have. And I think there's a lot of people whose lives are richer for it. So
thanks.
So let's talk about some fun stuff. So Eclipso, Darkness Within. It's all right. You got to redesign the character. It's a massive crossover event. Dude, I went nuts for this thing. I loved it so much. I still do.
Still you actually the best gimmick ever.
What's that?
I still think that gem's the best cover gimmick ever.
So, all right. The funny part is, see, I worked in a comic shop at that time. So I loved the gimmick, except every comic in front of it got screwed.
Yep.
So here we go. So the high profile event, you get to redesign the character. You really set the tone for every annual. I mean, artistically, all the annuals kind of followed your style, at least as far as the Eclipso's look. How'd you get the gig, and how was that different from doing like a regular monthly series?
Well, it's a lot harder. And I've always tried, because it's commercial art, I've always tried to find a better, faster way to do things. And Eclipso, I knew, was a monster, you know, story with all these characters in it. I knew it was going to be extremely taxing and hard to do. And I didn't even finish it. I got behind, and Keith did some pages, and I don't think anybody else did. I think just Keith did. But so I tried to develop a different style, a different look for the art in Eclipso that I thought would be faster, but would still have some rendering in it. So I did all these lines across the whole form, you know, to kind of give it some tone and some gray and different values and to kind of separate things. And that ended up being so time consuming. And then I was locked into it, and you know, it really needed to be finely inked, you know. But anyhow, it was after I quit Justice League and I did the Dark Knight thing. Mm-hmm. There were some issues there, and sort of as a not a gift to me, but like, okay, there's been some problems here. Do this big crossover event. Michael Urey was the editor. Great dude. We got along great. And so I just started humping on that. And, you know, it was nuts. Started in the jungle, and I went crazy with all the stuff and the lines and stuff. And then characters are thrown in and more characters thrown in. Oh, no. But no, it was a fun story. It was a good story. And, you know, it was great that it was a crossover event, a big DC event. I mean, I was thrilled to be on it, and pretty lucky. And then I got the Eclipso monthly, which I honestly didn't like much because I thought it would be more of the same, all the superheroes and Eclipso, and finally we're going to do a villain comic, right? But, you know, then they put him in South America and drug lords and stuff, and I was like, oh, I want to fall asleep. And at the same time, Acclaim started heavily recruiting me to do EXO and Turok. And I didn't want to leave DC. I think at that point I still had a 7-year exclusive in front of me. And I really didn't want to leave that because it was health insurance and all kinds of stuff, which Valiant was offering as well. But I liked DC. I enjoyed the people there. You know, I really enjoyed going to the office. It was a fun. It felt like a family. And I begged them for like a decent, you know, I want to do a series, a miniseries or something, you know, 2 and 3 issue, 4 issue stories, you know, that I could sink my teeth into with heroes. And they just didn't come through. And I guess they didn't think I would actually quit. And I did and left.
Well, you certainly made a big splash over at Valiant. So you mentioned the Eclipso thing. So let's talk about this for a second. So you're kind of in the pantheon of 90s cover enhancement guys. I mean, you've got, you know, Turok Dinosaur Hunter #1 with a chromium cover, which is legendary for good and bad, you know, for the number of issues they printed. You've got Eclipso with the diamond, which again, good and bad for the damage to the other comics. So let's take those two off the table, right, for just a second and say, out of all cover enhancements of the 90s, I don't care whether it's yours, somebody else's, whatever, what besides those two, what's your favorite some enhancements from the 90s?
I don't know that I have any. I've never been a fan of them.
Okay.
You know, I thought the Eclipso one was good because it made sense in the story.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was really cool.
I thought that one made sense. Turok was initially supposed to be the full cover.
Right.
And the company doing that failed and couldn't do it in time for the print run. So that's why it had the altered cover and, you know, included in the center. You know, and it was all right. The chromium stuff, you know, that's got a look. It's kind of cool. Maybe my other favorite is the full chromium one that came out for EXO Zero, whatever it was that Joe ended up drawing.
That was beautiful. That was a beautiful one. Yeah.
I mean, that was a really pretty. I thought the covers looked great on the chromium like that with the black and the computer color and stuff. It looked pretty cool. I don't really remember any others, to be honest.
No worries. There were a lot of them back then. Yeah. So was I the only one ever who got multiple copies of Eclipso so they could peel the gem off and hold it up to his eye? Because I'm afraid I might have been the only guy who was doing that. I'm not sure.
No. I've heard that multiple times.
Okay. So, all right.
Polaroids of people with it.
Right. I always thought that would have been a fantastic giveaway. You know, they're doing Green Lantern rings. Why didn't you give away the gems? It would have been perfect. All right, so it is time for the lightning round, Bart. So I'm going to give you a rapid-fire questions. You got about 5 seconds to answer each one, and we're going to have some fun here. Here we go. Are you ready?
All right.
First question, what action figures do you have on display in your studio or office right now?
None.
Oh, okay. Which Justice League Europe villain is the biggest lovable loser?
Justice League Europe villain? You
do understand how long 5 seconds are, right?
Yeah, I do. I got nothing. I got nothing for that. I don't know.
I think I heard him say Lord Havoc. Yep, I think I did. Okay. do you own any superhero pajamas?
No longer.
No longer. Okay, you did. All right, so we'll count that. That's good. All right, so both Turok Dinosaur Hunter and EXO Man of War have both appeared in video games. Have you ever played any of these games?
Yes, I played the one Turok one that Acclaim put out, which I thought was a pretty good actual game at the time. I don't think it holds up now, but at the time I thought it was pretty cool.
Awesome. Okay. Now it's been 34 years here. So without hesitating and no research, what does the acronym COPS, C-O-P-S, stand for?
Criminal, no. Something Organization of Police Specialists.
Yes, Central Organization of Police Specialists. Well done, well done. So, throw your mind back to 1989. You're into superheroes, you're into comic books. Did you ever eat the Batman breakfast cereal that was out at the time? Did not. Okay.
No, I did not eat it.
It was good. It tastes like Captain Crunch.
I should have had some then, because I like Captain Crunch.
And it came with the piggy banks vacuum sealed on the front, and I used that for years, but... So of all the comics in your collection, however many you may have, that you were not involved in creating, which ones do you personally treasure the most?
I have a lot of early Thors and early Iron Mans, the Coletta, George Tuska and Coletta stuff. I think I treasure those most.
Nice. Good choices. So of all your favorite characters out there, whether you've drawn them or not, like which one would you like to draw? Actually, let me change that. Ones you haven't drawn. Out of all the characters out there, who would you most like to draw professionally or personally?
That I haven't drawn?
Or maybe you have drawn. Who do you want to draw the most?
I would love to do a monthly run on Detective.
Really? Okay. Do you want the whole Bat family? Do you just want Batman? What do you want?
Batman. Detective okay. Comics. You know, and what that means to me, which is Batman being a detective superhero.
Right. Right. That would be amazing.
A run on that. That would be awesome.
We would all endorse that. I have no doubt. So, and what is the last question of the lightning round? What is the most unusual thing that you've been asked to autograph?
Man's belly.
His belly.
I did a Dragon Con in...
well, that makes sense right there, Dragon Con.
Early 90s, and I was going to the show, and it's in that huge complex in Atlanta. I don't know. You know, this football stadium-sized rooms, and I'm walking through there. I think my wife was with me, and I hear someone screaming my name, and I look over, and there's a heavier gentleman running at me, screaming my name from 100 yards away. And as he gets closer, he pulls up his shirt and he's got a Sharpie. He's like, "Would you sign my belly?" I was like, "Okay, dude." That was it.
Only at Dragon Con. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. That was my first day there, my first experience at Dragon Con.
I went for about 15 years straight, so I can attest there's a lot of insanity. Absolutely. Well, you survived the lightning round, Bart. Congratulations.
Well, I tried. I think I only didn't answer one question. Maybe two.
No one's going to play back the tape. What did you say? You answered them all brilliantly. So tell the folks at home what projects you're currently working on and where they can follow you on social media or online or your website or whatever.
On Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, it's BartSearsArt.com, or it's Bart Sears Art. The website is BartSearsArt.com. I'm currently working on Drawing Powerful Heroes 3, the splash page, which is coming out. I'm going to launch it on Indiegogo in November.
Okay.
There's a sign-up page. If they go to my website, they can click and do an early, you know, sign-up page to get updates and notified when the campaign goes live and all that kind of
okay.
stuff.
Okay. Well, this episode will drop in November, so folks, it may already be live by the time that you hear this.
Awesome. Awesome.
I noticed you've also been doing some, you did a Justice League print recently, right?
Yeah, I did I got some prints on my website from some of the famous covers. I just did a recreation.
I saw that!
One cover, which I think is the first one I've done. Now, I've done that cover for a dozen other characters, you know, indie comics and commissions and stuff. But that was the first recreation I did. And next year I'm going to do another one of that cover, but I'm going to draw it like I draw now.
I was going to say, when I saw the black and white on the web there, I thought that was just someone found the original cover and was putting it up there. Because, I mean, you did an amazing job recapturing it exactly.
It's what we do. I mean, it's not exact. There's no way. I mean, I can't do two things the same exact way ever, even if I tried, you know, and beat my brains out. It just... You know, it's impossible to recreate some of the line work and different stuff, but, you know, it's pretty close.
Yeah, in the spirit of, yeah. So that's Justice League Europe number one. It was absolutely gorgeous. So, folks, you heard it. BartSearsArt.com is the website. That's where you can find him on social media as well.
Yep. All over the place, sort of.
Well, any closing thoughts, any happy memories of your time on Justice League? Anything that just stays with you after all these years?
Well, one thing I'll always remember, which I find humorous, is Keith. Whenever he had whatever stupid idea he had, he'd write on a slip of paper and throw it in like a fishbowl or a candy bowl.
Okay.
If he needed a Justice League idea, he'd just fish around in there and pull one out. Then it might be, you know, the heroes go to school, and that's how issue 6 came out, you know. He would just use that to spark whatever direction. So there was no grand plan, no rhyme or reason. It was just whatever he pulled out of a fishbowl was that issue.
Well, it worked because, I mean, you were on the book, 20-something issues, and all of them were phenomenal. It was absolutely great.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. What a fun time for comics, man.
It really was. It really was. This is my favorite era, and that's why this podcast, by the time I'm done, will have taken me 8 years to cover all of the Giffen DiMatteis era. So commit a lot of time to it, but I love it.
Awesome. That's great, man. I mean, I really appreciate it. That's super cool.
Well, thank you so much to you, and I know everyone at home listening really appreciates all your insight.
All right. Well, thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Justice League International Pwahaha Podcast. You can find all the back episodes on our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com. And in those episodes, we're going through all the Giffen DeMatteis era of the Justice League, so Justice League America, Justice League Europe, Quarterly, all that, issue by issue, in release order. Also, be sure to go to our website to leave your comments on the show post. That's where most of the discussion is happening. You can also find us on Twitter as JLI Podcast or on Facebook as Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast. Again, a huge thanks to Bart Sears for coming on the show to discuss his time drawing Justice League Europe. Wasn't he amazing? Oh my gosh, it was such a fun interview, and he was such a great guy. All right, so that's it. So folks, come back next episode when we cover Justice League America number 51 and Justice League Europe number 27. And we'll have two guest hosts to help me cover those issues. Who will they be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. That's going to do it, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag, and you've been listening to the JLI Podcast. Want to make something of it?